Governor Bruce Rauner spent yesterday outlining his proposal for our state's next budget. He wants to roll back the income tax hike that went into effect last year when lawmakers overrode his veto.
The people of Illinois are taxed out. A $1 billion income tax cut should be our number one objective by the end of this session.
But his budget also uses the same money from that tax increase, and Democratic leaders say they might move ahead on a budget without him. Here's Senate President John Cullerton.
We'll see if we can get some cooperation from some Republicans. They may be of a mind to unite with the majority of Democrats and see if we can just pass a balanced budget without the governor's help again, just like we did last year.
Plus, a new proposal by the Trump administration would convert food stamps into boxes of packaged food. Some hunger relief groups are deeply troubled. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As you may have just heard during the newscast, President Trump just spoke from the White House about the latest school massacre, this one near my hometown of Miami in Parkland, Florida. He said, quote, "No child, no teacher should ever be in danger in an American school. No parent should have to fear for their sons or daughters when they kiss them goodbye in the morning." 17 people have died in the 18 school shooting this year. Yes, it's only February, and we're at 18 school shootings. It was the worst death toll at a school since Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. Stay tuned to this NPR station throughout the day for the latest on that tragedy. For us today, we're focusing on events closer to us here in Illinois. Yesterday, Governor Bruce Rauner proposed next year's budget for the state. Among the ideas he raised, shifting costs away from the state for teachers. That means having local school districts pay for their own teacher pensions. For state workers, that means carrying more health care costs. He also talked about cutting our state income tax rate, which rose to 4.95% last year.
Our fiscal year 19 proposal asks you to engage with us to make sensible, long overdue reforms, to shift control to the people who pay the bills. Move pension and healthcare costs where they belong. Most importantly, give local governments the tools to cut costs. Reduce workers' comp rates. Sell the Thompson Center. These savings will produce a surplus to put against our bill backlog. Better yet, they will energize our economy. If you'll work with me to take the next logical step and pass true pension reform, we will be able to enact a nearly $1 billion tax cut and start rolling back the income tax rate.
It's Governor Rauner yesterday with his budget proposal. It's meant to be just that, a starting proposal, and especially when it's a Republican governor and a democratically controlled legislature. Last year, to end the 2-year-long budget impasse, a group of Republicans broke with the governor and their party to join Democrats in overriding Governor Rauner to create a budget. Could the same happen this year? In a few minutes, we'll be joined by WBEZ Chicago's Tony Arnold, who was with me yesterday in the state capitol as the governor presented his budget. He'll give us some more analysis. But first, yesterday, just after the governor spoke, I had a chance to speak with Senate President John Cullerton. He's a Democrat from Chicago representing Illinois' 6th Senate District. Senator Cullerton, your thoughts on what Governor Rauner said. I noticed as during the speech, the chamber was much more quiet than it has been in years past, with from your colleagues reacting at different points. What's your immediate reaction to what
Well, for his
said?
Last budget message in his career, this was probably the closest one to a balanced budget. So he saved his best to the last. He's hopefully not going to be giving any more budget addresses. It was incredibly deceptive, and it was political, and so therefore disappointing. The background, though, is even more interesting, because the reason why this budget wasn't as unbalanced as the past is because of what we did last year. What we did last year was to provide the revenue that he asked for in last year's budget, but then he went and vetoed. So he complained about the fact we raised taxes. He calls it the Madigan tax increase, but he's spending all of it in this budget.
Well,
all of it.
And
he's not calling for anybody to roll back that tax increase or to eliminate that tax. He's using all the money to attempt to get to a balanced budget.
So there are a couple of things here that I imagine you all will take issue with. Let's start with education.
He's cutting education. I'll make it that clear. He makes it look like he's giving $350 million new dollars as per the new school reform bill. That's what it requires. And at the same time, then, he's sending them a bill for $500 million for their pensions with no warning. Okay, we had talked about this concept of shifting some of the costs back to school districts so that they would pay their pension costs, just like Chicago does. And we phased it in over 12, 14 years so that they could prepare for it without having to, you know, raise property taxes right away. So this guy just sends them a bill for $500 million after we give him an extra $350 and says that he's increasing funding for education. He's really decreasing it.
There were also a couple mentions of health care costs. And
okay, he wants us to pass a bill that says, oh, we're going to just cut $500 million out of the group health insurance, which covers all state employees, all university and community college employees. When 4 years ago, when he got to be governor, he was offered by the union, AFSCME, health care reforms in the new contract that he never got around to signing with them. And he was so anti-union his first day, called for a right-to-work state, that he, for now 3 years, he hasn't been able to do a contract. So he wants us, once again, to try to pass the law, just unilaterally taking the negotiations off the table, something that's just not going to happen. Keep in mind, many of his own members, he never even realized this. There are many Republicans who are pro-union. They're prison guards. They're school teachers. That's how he almost lost his primary the first time he ran against, I think, Kirk Dillard. And so they're not going to vote for these things that he's proposed. He wants to increase their health care cost, and it's just not likely to happen. If he can sit down and negotiate a contract with AFSCME, they've even offered him some savings. He can get some, but not as much as he expects to get in this budget.
Senator, are there any things in here you see as starting points for negotiations?
The irony is it's the money that we came up with last year in a bipartisan fashion that makes the gap not as great as it was before. And so in this, by the way, this concept of lowering people's taxes, which is 2 years away. If what he wanted us to pass, that he proposed on this pension reform, it would be 2 years away from being implemented. But that ship has passed. That's the bill that I put in the grand bargain that passed out of the Senate. And then he undermined the grand bargain. Don't forget, Senator Redonio quit after dealing with this guy last year out of frustration. She was my Republican counterpart. He came in and undermined the grand bargain that she and I had been working on for the first half of the year. And so these reforms that he talks about, workers' comp reforms, they were offered and rejected. Property tax freezes, they were offered and rejected. We did pass some consolidation legislation. Another thing that Republicans don't like to vote for, even more than Democrats. We did have some reforms last year, but over his objection and over his veto.
Do you have a sense then that you brought up the grand bargain, like last year, the lawmakers will be working amongst themselves to pass a budget?
Oh, that's what I think is going to happen. We'll see if we can get the same cooperation from Leader Brady that we got from Leader Redonio. We work together with the four leaders can be much more effective at negotiating than this governor. I saw him this morning. I asked him some questions. He has a blank stare on his face.
What did you ask him?
Oh, I asked him why he was blasting last year's tax increase that he called for in his own budget and vetoed and now not eliminating it. And he just has a look on his face. I'm like a pollster just wrote his speech. A pollster. I got to be able to say I'm increasing money for education even though I'm cutting it. I got to be able to say that I'm going to be more. I'm going to have more money for cuts for health care, which are never going to pass. It's so deceptive. I can tell you one more thing about Chicago. He still seems to have this this reason to try to separate Chicago from the rest of the state. In his proposal for pensions, the state of Illinois will pay $4 billion. For the suburban and downstate teachers' pensions, in his proposal, Chicago gets zero. That's what's in his budget.
Senate President John Cullerton from Chicago represents Illinois' 6th Senate District. One last question for you, Senator. Where do you go from here in terms of what's sort of your plan up from now through May to have something
with regard
passed
to a budget, like we did last year? Mm-hmm. We sat down and worked with Republicans. We will look at in closer detail this year's budget. We'll see if there's some things, some savings that we can implement, just like we did last year. It's going to be very difficult to do what he's put it in this budget. We'll see if we can get some cooperation from some Republicans. You know, there's a lot of Republicans who are leaving, people who overrode his veto in the past year. They may be of a mind to unite with the majority of Democrats and see if we can just pass a balanced budget without the governor's help again, just like we did last year.
Senate President John Cullerton, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
We'll be speaking with one of those retiring Republicans, David Harris, later on in the hour. I also had a chance to catch up with him yesterday after the governor's budget address in Springfield. WBEZ Chicago's Tony Arnold is with me now for a little bit more analysis. Hi, Tony. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Noah. Good to be here.
So let's go over some of the highlights. First of all, what the governor proposed. Education and teacher pension costs have been getting a lot of attention. What's the plan regarding shifting teacher pension costs to local districts?
Well, I think what you just kind of heard there from the Senate president is this idea of how little they're going to be able to work together over this budget proposal that the governor introduced yesterday, particularly because it relies so much on this idea that you just talked about, the cost shift, which is shifting the cost of teacher pensions from the state, which pays for it now, to local school districts. This idea has been around for a while. It's been debated, though not really voted on in a substantial way. And so people mostly have their minds made up if they're for this or against it. Those who are opposed to it include a lot of education groups or school districts themselves. They're saying this is they're actually, honestly, they're freaking out about it, is the technical way to say it. They are very scared of this idea because it's just going to be a substantial amount of money that they're going to have to pay for it. The opponents say the only way to actually find the money for the school districts to pay for this is to raise property taxes, which has been, ironically, one of the biggest things that Rauner has opposed in his time as governor, has been raising property tax. He's spoken out time and time again about that. Also, oddly, one of the biggest proponents of this cost shift on the supporter side is House Speaker Michael Madigan, who's been kind of suggesting that this happened for a while now, though granted he hasn't pushed for it with all of his might. And so it's interesting now to see Rauner and Madigan agreeing on this issue that, considering those two have been the biggest rivals of anyone throughout the last 3 years in Springfield.
Right. And Tony, because this is actually an idea that Speaker Madigan had also proposed, does that mean that it's possibly likely that they'll agree on this? Or because Governor Rauner has now proposed it and because the two haven't exactly cooperated very well over the past couple of years, does that mean now that Speaker Madigan will oppose it? Was there any hint?
Right.
What did we hear from his, maybe not directly from him, but from other folks who were around him yesterday?
Yeah, I could see them still agreeing in principle on this, but does that mean that they start working together in the same direction to get the same result? No, that doesn't mean that at all. Like, there's so much bad blood between them, and if anything, the day before the budget address, or Madigan was saying that Rauner's key objective is to make sure that he's no longer speaker. So there is no real motivation from really either side to work together on much of anything, which I think calls into question how real this budget proposal is in terms of working with the legislature to pass it. But then two is, what's this mean for passing any kind of budget? Part of what I took away from the Senate president's comments there in your interview with him was he's calling for Republicans to once again kind of ignore Bruce Rauner, but work with the Democrats to pass something around the governor. That's not an easy task to do. It's going to take a while to get there. It's raising some big questions about whether there can be any kind of budget again, considering what it took just to pass the one that the state's currently, using right now in its current fiscal year.
You know, Tony, we just have a few minutes left, but I just wanted to ask you one last question about that possibility of not having a budget. And of course, the big incentive that the governor and lawmakers have to pass a budget is this is an election year. And there are cynics and certainly those who are running against the governor who were quick to point out that the budget proposal yesterday had a lot of campaign posturing. And so I wanted to ask you how much of this budget proposal was about campaigning?
I think a lot of it was, but that's not unique to Rauner. The other thing I guess I'd say is budget speeches come and go. They're an annual tradition. Every governor presents a budget address. And how many of them have actually have not been ignored by the legislature? This is not going to be a unique situation, I'd say, that the legislators are rolling their eyes. Part of the role of governor is to be the first to go out there and say, here's what I got, here's my proposal, and then take the criticism that's inevitably going to come from somewhere for
so
it.
I guess what's moved forward this year, Tony, is at least there's been something put forward that everyone can argue with, because that hasn't been the case in previous years.
Right, and I think that there is a sign of cooperation that I saw from Governor Rauner's speech, which is that he's actually calling for spending some of the tax increase. He could have easily proposed completely cuts-only budget, cutting services to universities, social services, any number of things, to say, like, this tax increase never should have gone into effect. He didn't do that. So to Rauner's credit, he's spending some of the money that was in this tax increase, which maybe is a sign that they're going to be able to work together, at least on how much money should the state be spending in the next 12 months. That could be one of the key points between the two sides as they negotiate here in the next few months.
Yeah, thanks for that, Tony.
Having a budget at all.
Mm-hmm. That's WBEZ's Tony Arnold. I want to thank him. Thanks for being with me, Tony. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Anna. Good to be here.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, publisher of scholarly and regional interest books and journals, allowing local and global readers to understand and engage with the changing world. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been hearing reactions and analysis of Governor Rauner's budget address yesterday in Springfield. It could be the governor's last budget address, depending on whether or not he wins re-election this fall. But there were many people in the audience who will definitely not be coming back to the Capitol next year. More than two dozen lawmakers have announced that they're retiring. One of them is Representative David Harris. He's a Republican from Illinois' 53rd House District, which includes areas in the northwest suburbs of Chicago, including Arlington Heights and Mount Prospect. I spoke with him yesterday at the state capitol. I started by asking him for his thoughts on Governor Rauner's budget address.
The governor has indeed laid out a plan which is workable. Whether or not it's going to be accepted by the General Assembly remains to be seen. Some of what he has laid out, he has proposed before. The changes in employee health care have been proposed before.
Those are actually, some changes have been proposed by Democrats before.
Well, some of them. One of the ones that drew the most attention, or one of the items that drew the most attention, was when he talked about reducing the pension costs. And one of the ways to do that is to do what's known as a cost shift, which is to shift part of the requirement for the employer portion of the pension costs, us being the employer, the state of Illinois, shifting a part of that back to the local school districts and to the universities. That's a fairly significant change.
What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are that it makes some sense, because the local folks are the ones that determine what the salaries are for their teachers, administrators, and thus they should understand and have a responsibility for the pension liability that come with those salaries. At the same time, though, And I will, by way of open admissions, tell you that I had sponsored a bill in conjunction with Representative Nekritz a number of years ago that would have shifted those costs back to the locals, but done it in a phased-in process over about 10 to 12 years so that they can get ready for it. The governor's proposal is 25% the first year. That's fairly significant for those local districts. And in my area, as an example, in the Mount Prospect, Arlington Heights, Prospect Heights, they're not going to get a lot of, those districts are not going to get a lot of money from the new formula because they are considered
wealthy districts.
Well, I don't want to say wealthy, but they're not at the level that they need the support that other districts do. So now you're putting an additional financial burden on those districts, and that's going to be hard for them.
You mentioned your former colleague, Representative Nekritz.
Mm-hmm.
She is one of a group, and you were also among a group of lawmakers. You announced back in October, if I'm correct. Is it October your intention to not run again?
Right. I will not be running again,
right.
Correct.
And so, and a large part of that, at the time you said, was due to the budget impasse and to how that transpired. And I wanted to just ask you what your feelings were as you were thinking, as you were sitting in this budget address, knowing this will be your last one.
Well, let's hope that this budget resolution or this budget disposition, it's often said that the executive proposes and the legislature disposes. In other words, the executive can propose something and the legislature will do what it wants to do. So let's hope that that we can come together and craft a budget, because the lack of a budget for 2 years, in my mind, was disgraceful. It was irresponsible. And to use one of the words of my colleagues, it was immoral. People were being hurt. And I think that's why you saw so many Republicans, especially from downstate Illinois, cross over and say, we absolutely have to come together on a budget. And I think that's important. And there's a recognition that crafting a budget is the primary responsibility of any legislature and the governor for any fiscal year.
I wonder if you could characterize what you thought the tone was of the room today compared to previous years. Do you feel like, and I wonder how much of this is if there's more cooperation simply because it's an election year, but do you feel like the relations between the governor and lawmakers, how would you characterize that right now?
I don't know if the relationship with the Democratic legislators is much better. Even on the Republican side, there's somewhat of a difficulty because, of course, the governor is being challenged for renomination by a member of the House. So that's somewhat sticky. I will tell you that I was a bit struck that the reaction to the governor's overall speech was, in my mind, somewhat subdued on both sides of the aisle. There were not a lot of instances of people standing up and clapping and cheering loudly, even when he talked about a possible reduction in the income tax. There were relatively few applause lines.
That said, you were leaving a legislature with lots of other, it's almost an unprecedented number of lawmakers who were leaving. And I wonder what you think the institution will look like next year.
I think it may be unprecedented, although I don't know how far back we can go to see how many legislators.
I guess in modern history. How about that?
I guess we could go back to the bedsheet ballot of 1976 or something and count legislators leaving. There are a lot of legislators who have been here for a number of years. And as much as people say, well, we need turnover, seniority does count for something, and it counts for experience. And there's going to be a significant influx of people who don't have experience. And in many respects, that's bad. It forces individuals to rely on staff perhaps too much. It forces individuals perhaps to rely on lobbyists for information, whereas those of us who have been here a number of years, when somebody tells us something, we can filter it through a filter of, okay, does that make sense or doesn't it? And I don't need somebody else to tell me whether or not it's right or wrong. So there will be a clearly a loss of institutional memory.
For you, do you have do you feel a freedom about this budget session? Because
well,
you're going to be retiring. I'm curious, just because you said that when we looked at what happened last year and Republicans who broke ranks and came together and said, look, we have to have a budget. This is immoral, to your words. I wonder if that is an easier decision for voting when you know that you are retiring.
So that I can do anything I want and the voters can't vote against me.
I mean, kind of.
I think all of us, and indeed you can be crass and say that, but I think, and I know for myself, and I'll speak for my colleagues, and I don't think I'm wrong in saying this, we have basic principles that we live by. And yes, I broke ranks with most of my Republican colleagues and voted for a tax increase because I thought it was necessary for our state. That doesn't mean I'm going to just willy-nilly go out there and change my votes on things. I weigh issues as carefully as I possibly can through what I think is a filter of what's best for not only the people of my district, but as an example, what's best for the state of Illinois as a whole. Which is, again, why I voted for a budget last year.
Representative David Harris is a Republican. He represents Illinois' 53rd House District, areas of the northwest suburbs of Chicago. This is his last term in office. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us,
Good to be with you, Nyla. Absolutely.
Our reporting from Springfield continues tomorrow. We'll be speaking with journalist Carrie Lester. She's the author of her book about reflections on sexual harassment in Illinois government and politics. It's called Know My Place. We'll also be speaking with two of the lawmakers she featured in that book, both from the Republican and Democratic side. So stay tuned to tomorrow's program for that. Millions of people who receive SNAP benefits could see major changes to the way they shop for food. SNAP, that's a supplemental nutritional assistance program, commonly known as food stamps. And a new proposal by the Trump administration would convert electronic food benefits for millions into boxes of packaged foods. It's being called the America's Harvest Box program. Also, on a related front, there's a petition that's just been signed by more than 200,000 people. They're asking the USDA to allow pet owners to use their SNAP benefits to buy food for their pets, something they can't do now. Joining us to explain all of this is Craig Gunderson. He's an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. Hi, Craig. Welcome back to the 21st.
Great. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Craig, let's start with this new food stamp proposal from the president. What's sort of the outline here? What would be in this harvest box?
Well, actually, what's going to be in the harvest box hasn't really been well specified, so it's not clear what exactly is going to be in that in the harvest box. But it's for reasons we'll be talking about. This is a definite step backwards in SNAP and would do grave damage to our country.
So the proposal would make it so that recipients who get at least $90 a month, Craig, am I right? Is that about 80% of food stamp recipients?
Who get at least $90 a month, yes.
Yeah, so half of their benefits would come from this USDA package. And from what we've seen of the reports, that would include shelf-stable milk, ready-to-eat cereal, pasta, peanut butter, beans. It wouldn't include fresh fruits and vegetables. What kind of health implications would that have? And how different would this be than what happens right now with the SNAP program, Craig?
So this is, as I mentioned, this is going backwards in time, is that before SNAP began in the early 60s, is there was commodity programs where people would go places and pick up these exact type of products. They would go there, pick up commodity cheese. They would pick up all these, shelf-stable milk, things like that. And for very good reasons is USDA decided that's not the most efficient or practical way to get food to people. So instead they moved towards using at the time food stamps, which were coupons that people could use to purchase food, and then evolved into currently the electronic benefit transfer cards that people use to purchase food. So Yeah, so this would be moving backwards, which is really too bad, because part of the reason why SNAP has been such a successful program is it gives dignity and autonomy to low-income households to make their best choices for their families, and this new proposal would be taking that away from them.
So the current benefit regulations allow for a card, right? And it's just sort of like a debit card. What can people buy and not buy under current regulations, Craig?
So under current regulations is that households can purchase whatever food items they want, with a few exceptions. So for example, you can't purchase alcohol or cigarettes, but also you can't purchase things like rotisserie chickens that are already prepared. But in the main is it gives families the freedom to purchase whatever types of food they want. There's really no restrictions on what they can purchase, which is also along with making this an efficient program. In other words, people just go to retailers and purchase what's best for their families. It makes it appealing to households. So one of the main consequences would be if we switch to boxes is that a lot of people would leave SNAP insofar as it's kind of a condescending, patronizing way to give people food boxes instead of giving them the autonomy to make their own choices.
So I want to get to that in a minute, but I want to just ask you just about the costs of this, because how the Trump administration said this could potentially reduce the overall cost of SNAP by $129 billion over the next 10 years. I just want to unpack a little bit of that and hear your thoughts on if you think this would reduce costs or not. I've seen reports from different folks who are follow hunger issues and food saying that they feel like this would end up being a more expensive program because it would be a lot more bureaucratic.
Right. It's somewhat ironic that this was even proposed, because it'd be a bureaucratic nightmare. At first, the government would have to decide what exactly should be included or should not be included in these boxes. That's going to be an absolute mess. And then we have to package all this. The government currently doesn't do any work with packaging food and sending out to it. And then we'd have to mail this to tens of millions of households across the country. This is going to cost a fortune. I mean, one of the reasons why SNAP is so effective is basically people go to the store where the food is already available using a card, and that's where their money is placed onto. So it's really a much less efficient way. So on the one hand, I think that it would really increase costs due to all these other costs, which I don't think they take into consideration. But B, one area where it would save is because people would leave the program. A lot of SNAP recipients would say, look, this just isn't worth it. The stuff that comes in the SNAP package, I don't eat. My family doesn't eat. Why should I continue on a program like this, which treats me so badly? So in that sense, it would save money. But it would be saving money by kicking people off the program. This is why this new idea to have these boxes, for those who are supportive of it, it's a pro-hunger idea.
Craig, as you think, you said something earlier about how this is a program that you think removes dignity from people who are on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program on food stamps. I wonder if you can just unpack that a little bit for me and talk a little bit about the people who use SNAP benefits and what why you think that that's an important thing to point out.
Okay, so there's for some government programs, people are given a certain amount of they have no choice over what they get. An example would be a program like WIC, where you have no choice over what you get.
So that's a women and children program, correct?
Mm-hmm. Right, which is one of the reasons why not a very popular program, especially as children get older, is they don't like the food that's in it, and so therefore they leave the program. So you have very low participation rates amongst children. The advantage with SNAP is that it gives, I mean, households have widely varying food needs, whether it be for food allergy reasons, whether it be for the ages of people in the home, whether it be for religious reasons or for whatever reason. People have a wide variety of different things that they purchase with SNAP. The program gives dignity to households by saying, we will give you the ability to choose whatever you want with these benefits. And it's really an affirming way to do things, as opposed to with these boxes. Is these boxes is almost, you know, in some sense equivalent to like treating individuals like animals. Like, well, here's your food you're going to be eating this month. And it's just a really demeaning thing. And so therefore is that, unfortunately, in our society, it's very difficult to be poor in our country. Okay. Is that this will make it even more difficult by further stigmatizing those who get SNAP, which is why I say it's It hurts the dignity of low-income households.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Craig Gunderson from the University of Illinois. Stay tuned. We'll pick this up just after this short break. You're listening to The 21st. For tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about proposals made by the Trump administration to how SNAP benefits could change. SNAP benefits, formerly known as food stamps, people are discussing now a change by the Trump administration. It's a proposal that would convert electronic food benefits for millions into boxes of packaged food. It's being called the America's Harvest Box Program. My guest is Craig Gunderson. He's an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. He actually teaches in agriculture and consumer economics. Craig, I guess I'm wondering, as we're talking about this, what if you see and what, as someone who's in this and studies this and knows the benefits of this, is there any benefit to telling people what to eat? In a program like this?
So I did want to say that part of the reason why, not all government programs are successful, but SNAP is really a model for a program insofar as it sets out to alleviate food insecurity in the United States, and it achieves that goal.
And how does it achieve that goal, Craig?
It achieves that goal based by giving people more resources to purchase food for their families. So these are low-income households without enough resources to purchase enough food for their households. So by giving households this just a little bit more money in order to purchase food, it, for millions, it raises them out of hunger into being food secure. And it just does an enormously successful job because it's so efficient. It gives people income through these EBT cards that they can then spend on food. In terms of your specific question about what's the problem with, why wouldn't we just want to tell people what to eat? I feel that there's lots of opportunities for people to be educated about, what is quote unquote healthy foods and what is quote unquote unhealthy foods. And let's give those opportunities to people. But I don't think it's the role of the government to tell low-income households what they can and can't eat. We don't do this for other groups. So every year I get a mortgage tax deduction. The government would never dare say to me, oh, Craig, here's how you should spend your money. Or when I used to work for USDA, the government would never tell me what I can and can't do with my paycheck every month. Or, for example, when farmers get subsidies, it'd be insulting if the government were to say to these farmers, here's how you need to spend your money. So it's really condescending and patronizing whenever the federal government tries to tell low-income households what they can and can't eat, and especially insofar as they wouldn't do that with other groups.
What would happen for this new proposal to go through? What would have to happen?
It's not going to happen. Is one good thing about our one of the great things about our country is that there's been strong bipartisan support for SNAP because both sides of the aisle recognize that this is an efficient, successful program and they want to keep it going the way it is. Moreover, there's been lots of bipartisan support for anti-hunger efforts from both sides of the aisle. So in other words, is that the House and the Senate are wise enough to know that this is not a good idea and it will not be approved. So that's the good news. The bad news is that this is even – I'm happy you brought me on the show to talk about it today, but it's really too bad that we have to spend time talking about this rather than talking about all the neat things we could do with SNAP to make it an even better program.
Mm-hmm. Craig, one last question I just wanted to ask you about, and this is on a related note. There's a petition out there that's actually, as you're talking about changes to SNAP benefits, this is somewhat related to include pet food on food stamps. Can you tell us about this?
Right. So there's been a proposal by some to allow people to use SNAP benefits for pet food. you know, this to me is kind of a, well, it's a bizarre proposal. I don't really understand why it was proposed. Well, maybe I understand why it's proposed, but it would just be a nightmare. I mean, right now is the way SNAP is constructed is, if a household, the amount of money, the amount of benefits a household gets depends upon the household size and the household structure. So it's not clear to me if all of a sudden you said had pets, would people get more, you know, if they have a Bernese Mountain Dog versus if they had a Sheltie, or do they get less if they have a bird? It's not clear at all how this would ever be decided in terms of benefit levels that people would get depending upon this. So no, SNAP is designed as a way of addressing food insecurity and hunger amongst in the United States. It's not designed to be a program so pets can get more food.
Craig Gunderson is an agricultural economist who teaches in agriculture and consumer economics at the University of Illinois. Thanks, Craig.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
Today, we're airing the last of our series of interviews with candidates for Attorney General. The current Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, isn't running for re-election. There are 10 people who are hoping to replace her, 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans. The primary is on March 20th. In some cases, early voting has already started, so check with your local county clerk's office. Here's how we did this, like a job interview. We tried to ask each candidate almost the same questions. We also recorded all of the interviews in advance. Today, Scott Drury is a state representative from Illinois' 58th House District. It's a North Shore of Chicago district where he served since 2012. Previously, he was an assistant U.S. attorney's with the U.S. Assistant Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Illinois. I should note that earlier this month, a Cook County judge ruled that Representative Drury's name should not be on the primary ballot. The judge said that Drury submitted an electronic disclosure form that was the same one that he used when he ran for the state house. I'm sorry, an economic disclosure form. Representative Drury has appealed that decision. Until a decision is reached, his name will stay on the primary ballot. Representative Drury, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been a representative in Springfield, as I mentioned, for the past few years. You were actually running for governor, but then you dropped out of that race to run for attorney general. Why?
Well, I was running for governor, and then Lisa Madigan made the surprise announcement that she was going to be retiring. And when you look at my background as a prosecutor, prosecuting public corruption and trying to clean up the state, as soon as she made the announcement, pretty much everybody I knew started calling me and saying, hey, is this something that you think you'd want to do? And it was just a natural fit, and so that's why I'm running for attorney general.
You mentioned Lisa Madigan. We've seen her join other attorneys general in suing the Trump administration. Do you think part of the role of attorney general is to take on the federal government?
The role of the attorney general is to be the lawyer for the people of the state of Illinois, and to the extent that there's a federal executive order that's infringing on the civil rights or any of the rights of people in the state of Illinois, it's incumbent upon the attorney general to take action. So I applaud the actions of the attorneys general across the country who have been really the only roadblock to some of these really bad policies coming out of the White House.
What do you see as the main role of the attorney general?
I think the main role of the attorney general is to be in office, to be the lawyer of the people of Illinois, and be in an office that people can look to and say, I trust that office. There's such a vast wasteland of trust in the state of Illinois. And so I'm running for this office to clean up the state, to let people know that there's someone in Illinois who's fighting for them and not just working for the politicians.
And when you say clean up the state in particular, what would you like to focus on?
You know, going back to my background as a prosecutor, you know, we certainly need to look at the issue of public corruption. For too long in the state of Illinois, the state has outsourced the investigation and prosecution of public corruption to the state's attorneys and basically to nonprofit organizations like the Better Government Association. We are going to bring that back in-house. We're going to do public corruption in-house. And people in the state of Illinois, if you're a corrupt public official, you're going to know that if you do something wrong, then the weight and force of the Attorney General's office is going to come down on you.
What other priorities would you focus on?
I think we need to absolutely look at the gun violence epidemic, not just in Chicago, but all over the state of Illinois, and the opioid epidemic, and how to tackle those issues. On the gun issue, I have experience working at the U.S. Attorney's Office. I took violent gun offenders off the streets. I took illegal guns off the streets, and was part of a federal program, Project Safe Neighborhoods, that successfully reduced gun violence in the very beginning part of this century. And what I know is that you need a comprehensive approach to the issue. It's not just about sentencing. It's about the societal issues in terms of education, in terms of job reentry, in terms of criminal justice reform. And so that's going to be a top priority. And like I said, we have to look at the issue of the opioid epidemic, which is leading to increased violence throughout the state of Illinois.
Just going back to the guns issue for a second, what's your position on the Second Amendment?
The Second Amendment, I'm not opposed to it. I think people have a right to bear arms, but I also know that people have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in this country. And so there are laws on the books that allow people to have firearms. But I also think, you know, we could have more laws that keep guns out of the hands of bad people. Gun dealer licensing. I'm a chief sponsor. I'm one of the co-sponsors of that legislation, and I think that would go a long way towards keeping illegal guns off the streets. But I also believe that in Illinois, no matter what the gun laws that we have are, if we don't have federal laws that mirror them, you're still going to have illegal guns coming in. So that's why my approach to the issue is looking at what causes gun violence. Why are people shooting each other in the city of Chicago? And that issue comes down to the societal issues I was discussing. If we don't educate people, if there aren't job opportunities, if there aren't education programs, if people go to prison and then they come out and they don't have any opportunity to get a job, then they might resort to violence. And that's what studies show. So we have to address that issue, and that's what I want to focus on. And the Attorney General should be up front and center on that issue. I can't pass the legislation, but I certainly can be the advocate for the people of Illinois to say this is an epidemic and we need to address it, and this is the comprehensive approach we need to take.
You also mentioned the opioid epidemic. We've seen Lisa Madigan take this issue on somewhat. What would you do with this?
Well, again, I think we need to look at what's causing the issue. And it starts with the big pharmaceutical companies that are pushing their drugs on people. And it starts sometimes with illegal arrangements between the pharmaceutical companies and doctors who are then prescribing these drugs when they shouldn't. And so from a criminal standpoint, a prosecution standpoint, we need to make sure if people are violating the drug laws with respect to opioids and prescribing them or giving them away when they shouldn't, that we get those bad apples out of the system. But we also need to deal with treatment and not put everybody who's addicted to drugs in prison, because those aren't rehabilitation centers. We should put more resources into rehabilitation. And we also need to look at the fact that this opioid epidemic is directly leading to some of this violence I was just talking about. When I've traveled around the state and talked to state's attorneys in the various counties, they say that they're starting to see increased violence because the gangs from Chicago are starting to come down to these various counties in the state of Illinois to sell heroin, because people who can no longer get opioids from their doctors are looking for another source of that high. And unfortunately, that's heroin. And so we have to, again, address the issue comprehensively. And as a former prosecutor who's investigated these crimes, as a legislator who's dealt with these issues from a government public policy standpoint, there's no one in this race with the breadth and depth of experience that I have to take on these issues.
Representative Jury, you mentioned your time in Springfield. We've certainly seen dysfunction there that is unparalleled. I'm pointing to the fact that we didn't have a budget for the past 2 years. And I imagine there are voters out there who might be jaded by how awful the environment is in the state house and wonder why they should trust someone who's been a part of that environment to be attorney general.
I agree with everything you said in terms of it's dysfunctional and people are jaded. I got into this race. I ran for office the first time because I was one of those citizens. I came from the U.S. Attorney's Office, where I prosecuted corrupt public officials. And so I thought maybe a better way to fix the system is to fix it from the inside. And that's what I've done. The budget crisis, I was one of the Democrats from the very beginning saying the way to resolve this is to stop doing these piecemeal budgets that were harming people and just making this thing drag on and on. The other thing that people can take solace in is that I'm a Democrat, and I've always been a Democrat, but I'm not afraid to stand up to people in my party when I disagree with their policy perspectives. I'm the only Democrat in the last 30 years who didn't vote for Mike Madigan and be the Speaker of the House, and that sets me apart from almost everybody else in the race. I am going to stand up to powerful interests. I've stood up to them before, and I'm going to continue to do that, and I don't just say it. I have a track record of action.
That said, as you mentioned, there's a crowded field of candidates, 8 Democrats running, 2 Republicans. Why should voters choose you?
voters who are looking for an attorney general who can independently represent the state of Illinois, be an independent leader and law enforcement official in the state of Illinois, really need to look at this campaign. Like I said, I've been a lifelong Democrat, but I don't take my orders from the powers that be. My whole vision is to return government to its rightful owner, which is the people of the state of Illinois. And that's what I've been doing every day since I was a federal prosecutor and every day in my time in the General Assembly. It doesn't always make me popular with politicians, but that's fine because I don't work for the politicians. If people want somebody who's going to just take orders and continue the status quo, they can look elsewhere. But we have a real opportunity in this race to finally turn the state of Illinois around and elect an attorney general who is going to act independently and make sure that everybody is following the law and make sure that we have a government we can trust.
That's Scott Drury. He's a state representative. He represents Illinois' 58th House District, North Shore of Chicago, including Lake Forest, Highland Park, and Deerfield. He previously was an assistant U.S. attorney, one of eight Democrats running for state attorney general. Representative Drury, thanks for being with me.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the chance.
I'll be moderating a forum this evening, by the way, if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area with all the Democratic candidates. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.